During World War II, Australia was full of Americans. In fact, by 1943, there were more than 500,000 Americans based in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, and further north still, including Townsville, where our storyteller tonight has set her latest book. She's a storyteller who'll be well known to you. Judy Nunn was a stage and screen actress for many years, with, of course, a stint of 13 years playing Elsa on Home and Away, before embracing a career as a writer of historical fiction. And she's been digging out fascinating, often little-known stories from our history to tell. Now, this story is about the Americans who came to Townsville in 1942 as Australia looked towards America to save it from Japan during World War II. But in particular, it's about the African Americans who were segregated at home in the States and on arrival in Australia found those restrictions no longer existed, well, for a while at least. But before the war was over, there were riots, deaths, and a young officer called Lyndon Baines Johnson had been sent out from America to investigate what became one of the war's hushed-up incidents. Judy's been exploring the story in her new book, Khaki Town, and she's our guest on Nightlife. Hello, Judy.
Hello, Suzanne. That's a beautiful précis of the book. I don't need to say anything more about it.
You do, because there's lots to reveal. I mean, it's quite mind-blowing to get your head around the idea that we had these African-Americans who, you know, they'd been obviously freed from slavery, but they still didn't have the vote. They were still living with segregation, and they arrive in this country where we had the White Australia policy.
Absolutely. This is something that I very much enjoyed exploring in the book, along with the inspirational incident that happened, of which I'm sure we'll talk a bit, but my whole idea in the book is also to explore the racism of the day, both Australian and American. And of course, as you said, those African American soldiers, who of course were not called African American in those days, there was no such term, so they were Negro soldiers. They were referred to by the government, the military, everybody as Negro soldiers, or black, of course, which is still totally acceptable. So I had to put a little thing in the front of the book: please don't shy away from, I have to use the terms of the day. Now, these African American soldiers, when they arrived, they'd walk around the streets of Townsville, my book being set in Townsville, this mob of them, and they are labour units, actually, their battalion, there to literally, if not before the white troops, in order to build the infrastructures, the airstrips, etc., as labour battalions, and they'd be wandering the streets of Townsville, and there would be no signs saying for whites only, for blacks only. They can hop on a bus.
They can go into the pub.
Absolutely. They did tend to, with the Americans most particularly, the white and black Americans, they did tend to favour certain pubs. You know, the black soldiers would go, they'd adopt that pub, and the white soldiers adopt that pub. But there was no segregation. The Townsville pub owners are saying, sure, come into my pub. So that in itself would be a big eye-opener. And, of course, there was a great deal of aggression from the Aussie soldiers towards the white Americans. That wonderful old say, you know, oversexed, overpaid and over here. So there was, and they were paid three times the amount of the Aussie soldiers. So there was a lot of aggro there. But, yeah, the whole ballot. But, you see, in looking at the racism from both sides, Australia as well, you mentioned, and you're spot on, the white Australia policy. Well, when America sent its troops out here, the Australian government said, yes, yes, please, we need you, we need you. We're on the verge of invasion, which we were, but we don't want any black soldiers. We only want white ones. So that's what the Australians said to the Americans. So Franklin Roosevelt said, well, if you want Americans, if there's no black Americans, you're not getting any American soldiers per se. Good for him. So the Aussies had to rethink that. But General Douglas MacArthur, who was boss of the Pacific region, the American general in charge of the commanding general of the Pacific region, he made the promise to the Australian government, the Curtin Labor government. He said, we know that we understand your country's policies, and our Negro soldiers will be kept well away from urban areas, and we will get them out of the country as soon as possible. Do you believe that?
It's incredible.
It is, isn't
it? It's just incredible.
Yeah, and they were used virtually as slave labour. And
But war is a great leveller. And those white American soldiers who were really used to having the run of the chicken run at home, they weren't too happy to see people that they considered as inferior to them standing next to them in the pub chatting up the same girl.
Absolutely. And particularly, as you can imagine, those white Americans from the South.
Yes.
I mean, that's still, you know, sugar plantation mentality, you know, my daddy and all that sort of stuff really is. So it was a powder keg.
Now, you've got a lot of action taking place in the Brown's Bar, which is a fictional bar in Khaki Town. But I imagine Townsville's pubs were reaping the benefits of all those soldiers.
Well, they would be, except, of course, there were great big shortages of rations. So the pubs weren't open like 10 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. They were only open for a few hours a day. I think supposedly in many instances that's a bit up to the publican. But I think it was mainly later afternoon into early evening.
So you have more of your 6 o'clock swill kind of mentality going on.
A bit like that, absolutely. And the soldiers, of course, would be queuing up 5 blocks long, waiting for the pub's doors to open. But I have my publican of the Browns Hotel, my fictional hotel, which I love, and I love her, Val Callahan. And, she's got very good black market connections. So I use a little bit of, you know, dramatic license there.
Oh, the war was always good for black marketeers, wasn't it? Now, on a sideline there, you've got a little trick with a snake that goes on at the bar. I'd never come across the idea of staring down a snake as entertainment in a pub. Now, did you make that up, or is it something you've seen happening in pubs?
I haven't actually seen it happen, but I've certainly heard it happen.
Right.
And in many, I mean, I've written quite a lot of books based in very out-of-the-way places, a lot of desert areas, a lot of real, you know, rough outback sort of stuff. And it is true that in big mining way out there, mining settlements and everything like that, I mean, blokes will bet on two flies climbing up a wall. They really will. And so I had heard of a snake pen. And in the snake pen, the bet is that the man has to put his hand, and it's got to be a very aggressive snake, you know, an Eastern Brown, a mulga snake, and they've got to put their hand on the glass. And the snake is riled up by tapping on the glass and the plinth by the other people, and they have an observer opposite looking through, so that as the snake strikes, the bloke has to keep his hand on the glass.
And does he have to keep looking at the snake?
And he has to keep his eyes on the snake. And, of course, Eastern Browns, they rear up very high, so that in the wild, if somebody is bitten by an Eastern Brown, that bite will be usually on the thigh, because they rear up. Now, if that that snake pin is on a plinth up at sort of like knee level, then that snake coming at you is going to be coming at your face. Do you know what I mean? So nobody ever really wins the bet. And that's why the hotel is called the Browns, because of the snake pen.
Based in that snake. And I just wanted to go down that sideline because I love that little story. But look, Khaki Town is fiction. Well, it's historical fiction. So you're following, you know, you've got some very fictionalized stories, but there are some obvious exceptions. And in the book, something happens that sees the US Army enforce a segregation again between its black and white soldiers. What in fact happened?
Well, this is the – it's a bit of good and bad for a fiction writer. Nobody really knows, to be quite honest. They do know that there was this riot, stroke mutiny, where black soldiers turned against their white commanding officers. And then they were storming into town, which would call it a mutiny, and they'd been barred from town. So this is fact. What actually happened, they were prevented. So, and there was absolute heavy duty gunfire. By that, I mean, you know, machine gunfire in the dead of the night. So how many were killed? What was done with the bodies? Nobody, I think, will ever really know. I think there was some report, 19 dead. You wouldn't know, I think that. But that's good and bad for a writer of fiction. For me, I can make up what I know that is fact, that this event took place. How it, and also one knows for a fact that it was shrouded in secrecy, as everything is during wartime. it is wartime censorship. All radio, newspaper, all press, all media are told what they are allowed
Everything's got to get by the censors.
Absolutely. And Australia was a particularly, their censorship was even more controlled than both the UK and America. So we will only know whatever was, and it's never been allowed out, frankly. We will only know what other people have unearthed and placed on the net, etc., the odd historian or whatever. But the fact is that Lyndon Baines Johnson, as a 34-year-old congressman, was sent out by Franklin D. Roosevelt, ostensibly on a bomber surveillance mission as an observer. But he was, while he was there in Townsville for the several days he was there, he was to find out what went on and come back and report to the president, but keeping it all very hush-hush. So both the Australian and the American military and governments all wanted this kept quiet. I mean, they wouldn't want the world to know that there had been friction between their own soldiers on friendly foreign soil. That would be just the biggest no-no.
Especially when Australia said, you make sure that they behave.
Well, exactly.
And here they are mutinying in the night.
Yeah, yeah.
So you fictionalised then the lead up to this mutiny. So do we know anything about what caused all these men to grab all these weapons on that night? I think it was May 1942 and try
yes,
to...
May 22nd.
You know, try and shoot their officers?
Yeah. Well, they had been barred from town. And first of all, of course, as we were just saying a little while ago, so interestingly, they'd been welcomed. For all of Australia's, don't send us black soldiers... Indeed, the citizens of the various towns to which they were sent welcomed them. Well, particularly because we're on the verge of invasion. I mean, if the Japanese had actually known how completely vulnerable we were, they would have invaded. Mm. So that by the time the Americans came, we were on the precipice. I mean, Darwin was being bombed for a full year, not just that one day. Singapore had fallen, and our troops were serving overseas. All they were dead, they were taken prisoner in Singapore.
And just at the time this is happening, this is at the height of this. I mean, yes. We're just a couple of months after the fall of Singapore.
Yeah. So 1942, actually, as I made a point of saying in the book, was undoubtedly the most dangerous year in the history of this country. So when the Americans came over, I think townspeople, particularly in those northern areas where they knew they were the ones who were going to be overrun, thank God the Yanks are in town. Who cares whether they're black or white? Hello, buddies. And, of course, the black American soldiers were delightful. They were very polite and they were big and capable and strong. And I think it was, you know, a bit of a panacea too.
So we don't know, though. You say they did get barred from town, though.
Yes. And I have put in my book, and I believe, that they were used as scapegoats. There was a lot of, there were also riots in town and trouble, a lot of aggression between the black and white Americans. Also with the Aussies, they were larrikins, you know, and they really didn't like the white Americans having all this money to get the girls and be able to take the girls out and wine and dine them and all of this. So there was a lot of aggression. And in the sheer numbers of American troops out there. So I think the black troops really, as we were saying earlier, being seen as subservient, inferior, that feel of the day from the American hierarchy, they were sort of held responsible for the brawls and all of this. So therefore, keep them out of town.
And so here you are, you get this taste of where you've been treated equally. You've been called on to do your bit, not just for your country, but for this other country. Yeah. And suddenly, hey, get out of town. We don't want you.
Absolutely. And the camps were out of town, but the guys were allowed to come in. And there was R&R. There were nightclubs, lots of dances held by Red Cross and people. It's lots of dances, lots of music. It must have been the most vital time in Townsville. I mean, all that jitterbug and jazz and big band sound. The Americans brought all their music and everything with them. And the boys had all been enjoying this and walk into any pub and all of this and suddenly no. And that provided them with no R&R. There was no booze. There were no women. There were no dancers. There was no music. And furthermore, they're being, throughout the day, they're being used as slave labour. They are building those airfields, etc., with no machinery. There's not even, they are building with picks and shovels like they're on a chain gang. And then there's no way to unwind.
And then there's a moment you say, you know, one of them sort of remarks, it feels like we're on a cotton field.
Yeah.
You know, we might as well be.
Might as well be 100 years ago. Look at us, just black slaves. That's what we are. So, yeah, it was definitely really, really, they were shockingly treated. So I think that the riot is sort of built up of such frustration, it's virtually understandable. It's understandable.
Now, there's another aspect that plays out, which is rumours of the murder of a black soldier by a white officer. Is there any truth in that?
I've read of the evidently too, but I have fictionalised that. Mm. But it is based upon a definite rumour.
Right.
That was another reason.
Definite rumour.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this was just rumour in Townsville for many years, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
And there's another rumour or another piece of history you touch on where there are some railway carts opened which have bodies of dead black Americans in them who've been out at Mount Isa. What can you tell us about the story that came from?
Well, that again, that's not substantiated as in numbers of deaths, what happened to bodies or anything like that. Again, there are these probably vastly exaggerated numbers that nobody knows about. But it was evidently fact that up in Mount Isa, again, these black American troops, these African American troops were worked as slave labour virtually, and they were given no R&R outlet. They really are out in the back of beyond. And so they decided to make their own hooch, which is pretty understandable, and they brewed them up in barrels that were left from the mines, and those barrels had cyanide in them. So the hooch that the cyanide was impregnated in these barrels. So they died. And but nobody knows how many, nobody knows what happened to them or anything. But the report is evidently fact.
Judy Nunn is our guest on Nightlife. She's talking to us about her new book, Khaki Town, which takes place in Townsville during the Second World War. Now, Judy, the story sort of was only made public in 2012. There was a historian who found some documents about it. Is that where you came across the story? I mean, how did you find it?
Well, the historian of whom you speak, yes, I did have meetings with him in Townsville, and we chatted per se, took him out to lunch, had long chats. Yes, and he would be certainly the person who would know more than that, because he'd been doing a PhD on it for many years, actually. I just said, look, this is a work of fiction. As you haven't finished your PhD. I thank him for his PhD and to give him a plug, but I never read his PhD. I only chatted with him personally and got much anecdotal material. And, of course, everything that he had released on the web, most of which was actually via very involved ABC interviews. So that is all available on the web. Oh, but please don't go looking it up, everybody. Read my book instead. You'll have a much better time.
Judy's book is a great page turner. I've read it all pretty well in two sittings.
Well, you sound as if you have. You're a really full book on it. It's fabulous.
So to say, yes. Now, you've got LBJ coming to America from America to investigate. Did you enjoy writing him? You really went to town with him being a tough talking Texan with a big ego.
Absolutely. And you see, the beauty of that, Suzanne, is that there is so a wealth of material out there on LBJ, who, funnily enough, another nice little piece of trivia, was never known as LBJ until after FDR's death. He was such an admirer of FDR that the moment, he just then wanted to be known by his initials, you know, which became the end thing. Then there was JFK, of course. Anyway, Lyndon Baines Johnson was and has always been depicted to be a very ambitious man, very arrogant, a very clever man, a very clever politician, but bigger than life. And, you know, very, I had great fun writing him because I just most recently, Woody Harrelson played him in a film called LBJ, which didn't do well in the cinemas, and I don't know why. I thought it was bloody terrific, and I thought his performance was tremendous. I thought, this is Academy Award nomination. But I think it might have been just the title. Somebody expected the whole life of LBJ, and it wasn't. It was just his taking over as president. But he is such a colourful character and well-known to be such, so I adored writing him.
Yeah, I could hear it almost in the words that you put into his mouth. Now, after all of this had happened and LBJ had gone back to America, there was, in fact, a bar exclusively for African American soldiers set up in Townsville, wasn't there?
Well, yes, and that is well and truly documented because when Eleanor Roosevelt came out to Australia in 1943, a year after this, she went to Townsville and was a guest invited to this It was called the Negro Servicemen's Club. I think, you know, still the word Negro, but I mean, that was not meant to be impolite. It was, you know, but it was for African-American soldiers only. And that was evidently set up by FDR when he was horrified to discover, through LBJ's report, that the African-American workers, well, they were soldiers. Mm. They're not just workers. They did call them, you know, labour battalions, but they were soldiers. And he was appalled at the way they'd been treated. He actually saw the sense of all this, so he set it up R&R outlet.
Is that still there, that building, or has it gone?
Oh, I wouldn't have a clue. I would probably doubt it. I didn't go and look for it because actually my book finishes before that. That's only in the author's notes at the end. Yeah. It was opened in the middle of town in Flinders Street, yeah.
Right. Well, someone will probably be able to tell us if it's still there, or might even remember it. Are there parts of Townsville still where, with a bit of imagination, you can catch a whiff of 1942?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I find very often when I go to places that I research, I really can get totally transported to yesteryear. Like when I was writing a book called Territory, based in the Northern Territory, and it went from the bombing of Darwin to Cyclone Tracy, so two times destroyed within that short period of time. And Chinatown, for instance, was completely annihilated by the Japanese bombs. But I'm walking around where it was, and I've had wonderful meetings with the Chinese community who've shown me this great big model that they had of Chinatown, and I'm walking through Chinatown. And it's the same thing with, you can walk down the Strand in Townsville, this beautiful, beautiful big boulevard of a street, which is lovely. Look out across the ocean and you've got Magnetic Island there, and then towering above the town, you've got Castle Rock. Beautiful, beautiful city, Townsville. But I can see all the barbed wires, and I can see the landing barges and the slit trenches, and you know, you can just walk down there and picture it, particularly from the pictures that you've seen of the time.
Mm. Now, Judy, you also put a lot of Indigenous characters into this book. Was that a very deliberate move to show that, you know, race was an issue for all countries who were involved in this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, as we've said, the White Australia policy was still alive and well here. The Civil Rights Act, of course, was 40 years before it came into being in America. And I wanted that parallel, that we... sure, the Townsville people might have welcomed those wonderful, big, reassuring, strong black American soldiers. But there was this terrible, what was his name? He was in the army, Defence Force. He was in the Defence Force, Australian. And he actually put out orders that upon invasion, Aboriginal men were the first to be shot.
Oh.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and his naive, ridiculous assumption being that the Aboriginal male would probably front up to the Japanese invading forces in order to get, you know, come join me and I'll give you some alcohol and tobacco or something.
So the Indigenous citizens were to be treated as suspects.
Yes. And as we all know, I'm sure there were so many Indigenous, so many Aboriginal men went off to fight for our country. And then when they came home, they weren't even recognised. But it really does show how extraordinarily racially prejudiced we were.
Absolutely. Judy, just finally, you know, most of your books are historical fiction. Has history always fascinated you? Is it something you've come to later?
No, it's something I came to later, actually. I had lousy history teachers in my high school. Well, the only decent teacher I had was English teacher. So that certainly nurtured a great love of writing in me. I knew I wanted to write. But I wish I'd had better history teachers. I'm not getting at the teaching profession in this, I hasten to add, you know, but I had a better teacher when I was 10 in primary school who just was wonderful. He was a returned war veteran, actually, soldier. He was inspirational. But so it was much later on I developed a love of history, and it was when I decided to, in my third book, I decided, yeah, I'm going to set this in movie town like the publishers wanted me to. But I thought each book I wanted to be very, very different. So I thought I'll make his ancestors come out on the Bark Henrietta in you know, the 1850s, and I'll settle them in the Barossa Valley making wine next door to Dr. Penfold. at the Grange. You know, I thought, you better study up a bit on Owenology, I think, and you better find out. So I got so fascinated in everything that the historical research unveiled to me that suddenly I'm over 100 pages and I still haven't got to the descendant yet. I'm still into the, you know, who was going to then start movie studios that happened in the 1940s in Sydney, in Bondi and Beach and all this, you know. So I suddenly thought, oh, this is the way I want to go now. Historical stuff is the way I want to go.
That's right. Well, once you start, you just go down a rabbit hole.
Yes.
Don't you?
Look, fact is stranger than fiction is the truest adage I have ever heard.
Well, Junie, you've brought them both together beautifully in this book, which I really enjoyed reading. Thanks so much for talking to us on Nightlife.
Thank you, Suzanne. I could have gone on for hours. That was lovely.
Junie Nunn, author of Khaki Town.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.